Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 30th, 2006. Today's session is entitled The Politics of Health Care, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
Hi, thank you for coming. I'm John Marty. This is my last talk here after 2 weeks, and enjoy it. This one's on the politics of health care. I'm a state senator in Minnesota. I've carried a number of times bills to deal with health care reform and see us basically right now going the wrong direction. Anyway, this is a talk about the politics of health care. 45 million Americans don't have health care, health insurance at all, and a growing number of others who do have it are not much better off than that. And I do think, as I said, that some of the things we're doing that we call health care reform are actually making it more expensive, making the problem worse. Not intentionally, but the consequence is backwards from what people think it's going to be. And it's kind of a vicious circle here. We have higher costs, which makes it less affordable, and the less affordable it is, the more expensive the system becomes, which makes it, so it keeps getting worse that way. Well, I'm going to start out by talking about where I think we stand now and what the causes of that problem are, and then the types of solutions that are being looked at by various people, then open it up for discussion, debate, whatever. How do we compare to other people? I think I mentioned 45 million Americans lack health care. Put the number in perspective, it's about 1 in 7 people have no health insurance. That's a lot worse than most of the developed countries. Industrialized countries have universal health care. And it's not because we spend less, we spend a lot more. In 2002, the U.S. spent over $5,200 per capita. Now it's closer to $6,000 per capita in health care. If you think, oh, I don't pay $6,000 a year in health care, well, you don't directly, but a family of four is going to be $24,000 a year between what you pay, not just the health insurance premiums, but the co-payments, deductibles, everything else, and what your employer pays if you've got employer-based health care, and what the government pays. Between the three main sources of funding for health care in this country, it's close to $6,000 a person. That's a lot of money, and it's higher than these other countries that have universal care. Switzerland, we are about 60% above what the Swiss paid, and they are number two in cost. They are the second most expensive, and we're 60% higher than them, more than 60% higher. We're a whopping 80% more than Canadians pay per person, and Canada's not one of the lower ones. It's sort of the middle range. That's now about 15% of our gross domestic product. So everything, every dollar in the economy, about 15 cents of it's going to healthcare. And again, when you figure out what that means per person, it's about $2,000 a person more here than other countries. The places you really begin to notice it now is when automakers are building their plants in Canada instead of here. The main difference is, again, that the manufacturer is responsible for its employee health care costs here, whereas in Canada it's covered other ways. Our high expenditures aren't getting us better care. In addition to the 45, partly because 45 million are uninsured and many more underinsured, our statistics, the ones you generally use to measure health of the community, infant mortality rate, life expectancy, and so on, I mean, you're not talking decades difference. Some third world countries without good health care have decades shorter, but ours are years shorter of life expectancy, and infant mortality rates are higher, and those are things that once upon a time, the U.S. was tops in, but we've been slipping, and other countries spend less and get better for it. As the healthcare system costs rise, and we all see the problems of it, both business community and politicians are working aggressively to reduce the cost because they pay a lot of it. So business finds its ways to do it, often by increasing co-payments, deductibles, decreasing coverage provided. In government's case, it's more aggressively, well, we can't cover you, we can't cover this. They're trying to cut back, and the other thing everybody does is try and push the cost to somebody else. either push it to the consumer or business push it to the government or government push it to whoever's out there, which tends to be business and the individuals. What does this mean to typical people? In this country, half of all of our bankruptcies in recent years have been caused by health care costs. And you may think, well, these are those 45 million uninsured. No, 3/4 of the people who end up declaring bankruptcy because of health care, 3/4 of them were insured at the time of the illness. It's usually one catastrophic illness, whether it's cancer or heart attack or something else like that. They get sick. The average cost of that illness that puts them into bankruptcy is $12,000, usually out of their pocket. Usually it's partly because they lose their job and therefore their benefits, partly because they can't work, partly because the medical expenses are so high. But it is not just the 45 million who are uninsured. 3/4 of the new bankruptcies from healthcare are caused by people who have insurance, but they lose it or it's not sufficient or not enough. And we make our problem worse. I think there are 36 million people in this country who are what we might call, I think the new terminology is food insecure. They don't know if their groceries are going to last till the next paycheck. And at some points of the month, they may be going with skipping meals because they don't have it. All those things add to the problems with healthcare, because if you're not eating a proper diet, you're not going to, your chances of staying healthy are much worse. What does this impact on people's lives besides their economics? Well, the National Academy of Sciences did a study about 2 years ago now, suggested there are about 18,000 people in the U.S. die per year because of lack of appropriate health care. That's 6 times as many people as died September 11th. We changed a whole lot of things as we had to as a country because of that, but here you can have 18,000 people dying because of lack of appropriate health care in our country, suggests we need to make some changes. So what are the issues? What are the causes? Before we get to the solution, what are the causes? The generally assumed cause by government and business, and I think lots of the public and the media as well, is overutilization. We overuse our healthcare system, and therefore it costs too much. And the obvious suggestion of how you address overuse, you try and cut it back. One way we can do it is we can give higher co-payments or deductibles. Then people won't just go running to the doctor willy-nilly for everything. Most people I know hate going to the doctor. There's some hypochondriacs and some people who might be overly cautious or something, but most of us don't really like going to the doctor, and we try and minimize it, cost aside, even if it's free. I don't like going to the doctor. It takes time, and unpleasant things happen there. Even a lot of the preventive stuff is unpleasant. But so what government and business tends to do then is, again, try and shift the cost. Again, the assumption is if consumers have to pay more, they're not going to use it as much. And that's a good thing if you're overusing it. It's not a good thing if you need it. You don't prevent any illness. You don't do anything that inherently saves money by making somebody have to pay more of it. But it will tend to reduce the use of it, the number of times people go to the doctor. So federal and state governments, if Medicare, Medicaid get too expensive, you cut back on what you provide. You make the qualification standard for who can get it more difficult, and you provide fewer benefits. And again, same thing with health plans in the private sector. The fewer benefits is a big thing, and a lot of states, Minnesota and most states, have a lot of mandates. If you are an insurer in our state, you have to provide some prenatal care. You have to provide, in our state, it actually got to the point where you have to provide at least 24 hours after maternity care in a hospital. That may seem strange to us. Many older generations, I think the time I was born, I think average hospital stay for a healthy birth was 2, 3, 4 days. There are people who are going home the same day. In Minnesota, that was a problem. There were a number of cases where some woman had very serious complications, sent home too early, and the next day back in the emergency room. So the state in Minnesota and most states puts on certain mandates. You got to cover certain cancer types of things. You have to cover breast cancer screening. You have to cover this or that. And that's government mandating it because they're seeing private insurers covering it less, but government tends to do the same thing. Well, dental care is important. I've always wondered why our teeth are treated differently than other parts of our body. We have different specialists who deal with them, but hey, you have different specialists who deal with your heart from your liver and from your skin and so on. We have specialists dealing with all of it, but typical health plan in Minnesota is you get health care, and oh, dental, some employers will cover it, but we now know that dental care is not just as important as perhaps taking care of your fingers and your toes. Your teeth are not just important in themselves, but actually some types of tooth decay can lead to heart disease now. We've known that for several years. And therefore, it's very important, but that's one of those things that we push to the side. Mental health coverage. There's big push in Congress and in many states to require providers to provide mental health coverage because it's too expensive, so we won't cover it. So the way, again, that government and business deals with it is we tend to push aside this kind of coverage. It's too expensive. We'll ignore that. These people can't get it. We'll push them aside. But everybody's trying to get out of providing it. I'd argue that that's actually making our problem a lot worse for several reasons, one of which, shifting the cost to others, basically ups the administrative costs. Talking earlier about somebody about the billing and how everybody's trying to collect from everybody else, push the bills to somebody else. That's now over 30% of our healthcare dollars going to administrative costs. And that's not your administrative costs, that's the system's administrative costs. When you have to fill out all the forms, pay the postage to mail it in, you got to spend the time on the phone trying to figure out what's covered, what's not covered. That's not ever calculated as part of the healthcare dollar. However, the doctor's office, the insurance provider, everybody else, their time, if you calculate that in, it's over 30% of our expenses. And I just keep thinking when our daughter was little 20 years ago, we were out here and she had a dislocated elbow. We had to take her out to Chelan for a, because the nurse here didn't feel comfortable popping the elbow back in place without an x-ray, because if a nerve was pinched, could cause permanent damage. So we took her out to the hospital clinic. It took all of 2 minutes for an x-ray. The doctor pops it in place and puts a sling on, and it's done. And three bills, the clinic bill, the x-ray lab bill, and the doctor bill. Three bills, they totaled, I think, close to $200. Each one of them, a couple months later, we're back home, they send us the bill. Our insurance is supposed to cover, I think, 80% of out-of-area coverage. So we send it to them. Each bill comes separately, so we send three separate bills to our provider. And, you know, they got the paperwork slowed down and everything. They're going to pay it, but it takes a while, so we get three more bills from them. And a third set of bills, and by that time, our insurers, we're told not to pay until they pay. So then they pay, but before their bill gets there to anybody, two of them are already in collection agencies. Now, this is a procedure that may have been, the actual cost of providing outside of billing may have been $50, but at the end, it's $200 because everybody's billing back and forth, so you have that waste. The second cause of the problem is, again, the lack of preventive care. We do not do much of the preventive stuff when you're trying to save money. If the problem is people use it too much, well, don't go in when you're healthy. Wait until you're sick. And there are many cases I know in Minnesota, I assume elsewhere in the country, where parents don't take a child in for an ear infection because, you know, maybe it'll go away, and it sometimes does. But sometimes there are actually cases where people have hearing damage. And think of the cost of the hearing damage because you didn't go in quick enough to the provider. Certainly, overuse is a cause. There are people who overuse, and the biggest ways I would argue it's overuse are once in a while doctors are going to perform unnecessary tests or procedures, perhaps for financial reasons, perhaps for defensive medicine reasons. Defensive medicine, they're afraid of being sued, and therefore they do procedures they don't necessarily shouldn't be doing. They also have a thing in Minnesota. We have big fights at the legislature over who can control MRI machines. because we got more and more doctor groups that decide we're going to offer one of these, we're going to have our own clinic. Hospitals are having a fit because they need them to make ends meet, and you can probably do it more efficiently if you do it separately, but the hospital has to have one, and very, very expensive machinery. So, you know, once you got one in your clinic, you got to use it. So you might just sort of, well, it's there, we might as well refer it when it's a borderline case. So there are cases, there are definitely cases where overuse is a problem. Unfortunately, most of our corrective actions may not be getting at those particular things. They tend to be getting at the don't go to the doctor's often approach. So I would argue the other major cause, which is far, far greater, is underutilization. People don't go to the doctor when they need. And again, the emergency room is a lot more expensive place to treat people than the doctor's office for preventive care. And it's not just in individual decisions, it's also in public health. Our country's been cutting back public health spending for years, and now, well, we're actually dumping a lot of money in because of the scare of the bird flu. But to look at how ill-prepared we are, just think 2-3 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, when we had the shortage of flu vaccine because of the two providers, one had contaminated stuff. And in Minnesota, it was a circus because they're telling everybody, don't get your flu shot now, save them for the people who need them. Well, everybody took that to heart, including a lot of people who should have had them. And so everybody stopped getting them. And then later on, a month later, well, you know, we got more left, so we'll take anybody now. And just the rigmarole of deciding who does, what a message do we send? Don't get a flu shot because we got to save them for somebody else. The cost of the system, if we had a public health system that did this, would probably be far less if, I would argue, if government promised various health vaccine makers that we will purchase this many units of stuff, and you have, instead of two providers, you might have 20 or so manufacturing it. You make sure there's enough manufactured that everybody who should get a flu shot, which some would argue would be everyone, can get them. And then you have a public health effort to get people to get the flu shot. More and more employers in Minnesota, at least, that don't otherwise do so are providing flu shots to people because even if it's only 1 in 7 or 8 of their workers who gets the flu, they lose 2, 3, 4 days. And if it spreads to others, lots of people is 2, 3, 4 days, and the cost of the shot's a lot less. But our public health system is breaking, and we don't do the things that we should do, like make sure, I think the best idea would be to encourage everybody to get the flu shot. And now, at least because of the scare of the bird flu, big scramble for people to prepare for it, but we're not ready for it, and that's a totally separate type of problem from regular flu, which we can do a lot of prevention of. The third major cause, I would argue, of our problems are the way the financial system is set up. Not everybody's hurting because of our healthcare system. Some are doing very, very well. Minnesota's poster child for this is a guy who's head of the United Health Group. He's earned over $50 million for each of the past 6-7 years. I think last it was 90 or 100 some million dollars he makes in personal compensation. People say, well, you know, a few high salaries isn't what's driving a $1 billion system. But his salary alone last year, somebody calculated, would be enough if you reduced his salary for the last 2 years to $20 million for 2 years, $10 million a year. If you reduced it to that, there would be enough money left over there, and it doesn't transfer this way, but it's enough money in that many million dollars to provide care, health insurance for 77,000 Minnesota kids, which is the number who don't have health insurance now. Just one person's salary, and I know a person who works there, a top executive there, and I don't think she is in his ballpark, but I wouldn't be surprised if she's getting $5, $7, $10 million a year. And there are a number of executives in a company like that that do that. There are a handful of people making good money, and it's not just the for-profits. There's one nonprofit hospital system. I'm not sure. It's a national chain, I believe. But a nonprofit hospital system where the chief executive is making $7.4 million. When you have a healthcare system where people can't afford it, that's a lot of money. And it's not just the high salaries. Government sometimes makes this work. Boston University did a study of the new Medicare reform law of 2003, the one that provided prescription drug coverage to seniors, calculated that 60% of the new money going into prescription drug coverage here was going to be going into higher profit for the drug manufacturers, not into more people getting it. Why does this happen? Well, the government negotiates prices. The lowest prices anybody pays for prescription drugs in our country is Veterans Administration, by law. They get the cheapest price. Under the Medicare Reform Bill, Congress explicitly prohibited the administration from negotiating for prices on this. So now drug prices, as it's kicking in now, drug prices go up. And government cannot negotiate. It's explicitly prohibited from doing so. How did this come into being? Well, that Boston University study estimated over the next 8 years, it's going to increase the profits of the pharmaceutical companies, $139 billion, and they are already, their average rate of return on investment of Fortune 500 companies, the prescription, the pharmaceutical industry, is about triple the average of other Fortune 500 companies. So it's way up there already. It will get $140 billion more over the next 8 years. Why has this happened? Well, I'd make the argument that the prescription drug lobby in Washington is very strong. They spent about $180 million over between 2000 and 2004 on lobbying, advertising, campaign contributions. And, you know, from their perspective, $180 million is a lot of money. But if that increases their profits over 8 years by $140 billion, that's $800 or so, $900, close to $1,000 return for every dollar they spent in the lobbying and campaign contributions and so on. And it's bizarre. I mean, it's the only place in the world where a government's going to say, we're not going to negotiate with you. You just charge us whatever you want, and we're going to pay it. And that's effectively what they've done. So that's where you get a lot of the costs that happen. Sometimes it seems, as somebody in politics, that while there's a lot of anger and concern about health care, it seems that surprising how little vocal concern there is. When a candidate does talk about healthcare, people say, yeah, I agree. But how little concern there is in terms of the political process. And I would attribute that to a couple of things, one of which is people don't always see the connection between public policy and what they're paying on their medical bills. If anything, they see, well, we're paying money in taxes here. That's going to make it more expensive for us. And if government's covering more people, it's going to make it more expensive for us because we got to pay the taxes for it. And so perhaps because of that, partly because there's confusion in terms of what direction we go, it's so complicated, people aren't that vocal. And even if people are up in arms, there's no organized lobby of uninsured and underinsured people working for it. And every other, it's not like it's one side against the other, there are 50 sides. The other evening I was talking about a campaign financing issue, and when I was first elected, I got a letter from a lobbyist who said, one of my clients had the misfortune of giving to your opponent, here's a contribution, as they wish to make amends. And I was pointing out to people, you know, what's the misfortune of giving to somebody? Well, he lost. And so now they're wishing to make amends because I'm the one who gets to decide. I don't think they were deciding because of their belief that he was better for the state, or even certainly not because they knew where he stood on their issue, but because he was the one who was going to win. And now I won. Now I was going to be able to make that decision. What was the decision? Well, it was a debate, and I don't have a clue which side this guy was on, but he was representing either optometrists or ophthalmologists in big fights over whether optometrists should be able to prescribe drugs, because the ophthalmologists say, well, we got more training. We should be able to be the only ones. It's an economic fight between the two groups. And so they're sending all these campaign contributions to people who aren't even elected. And as soon as they are elected, you send them contributions to let them know, you're our friend. So they give money to both sides. In a single race, they'll give money to both sides because they do. And that's one industry, one small portion. That's the tiniest blip on the chart of healthcare issues. But that's what the system is set up like. And I do think, though, that the system is falling apart fast enough that people are getting desperate about it, and I do think it's going to erupt as a major political issue sometime in the next few years. Businesses are getting desperate, and more who want to provide benefits to their employees are saying we can't afford to. And they're really struggling with it because they know it's not right to drop it, but they can't make it. And that puts more people on the roll of who needs government help with it. And government's been cutting budgets. One of the ways, when we're talking about the overuse in Minnesota 3 years ago, as part of budget cutting, the state did a real brilliant move. It fits in perfectly with this. We added $1,000 co-payments for our general assistance medical care, which are low-income working adults without children. And we put $1,000 co-payment for hospital visits. If you're on that program, you are making less than $1,000 a month. That's about the cap for where you get into it. And if you are going to get hospitalized, first of all, you don't have $1,000, even if you are working, and when you're hospitalized, you're usually not working anyway. So these are folks who have very slim chance, probably 1 in 100 might be able to conceivably try and pay that $1,000 copayment. So the hospitals now, if it's a $10,000 procedure or hospitalization, they get $9,000 from the government, and the other $1,000, well, they have to bill you. So they bill you, and they bill you again, and they bill you again, and maybe send it to a collection agency. But they don't collect. So instead of $1,000, maybe they spent $200 trying to collect it. So now they're $1,200 in the hole. That doesn't just go away. They shift the cost to somebody else. So it's making the system more expensive. That's one government decision that in theory saves the government money, but I would argue doesn't. Well, what are the solutions? Frankly, the first thing I would do, regardless of what kind of scheme you decide, you ought to be kicking in with preventive care. Certainly for kids, that's what's the thing that's happening in most states where there's any action whatsoever. Let's at least give preventive care for kids. But preventive care across the board would make sense. I would try and divide the types of reforms being considered into three groups, one of which is the traditional cost containment personal responsibility model, which I say is what we're doing now. And if it's not doing enough, we try and do more of it. But that's, again, what I would argue is making the problem worse. It's the most common position among elected officials. The other extreme of the three choices, I would say, is the Medicare for All model. Universal, it's usually called single payer, though I don't know why somebody calls it that. We're kind of getting to two or three payers in Minnesota now, the state and three big health insurers. But this is the least popular among politicians and in the business community, has a strong following among some medical providers, some consumer groups. Senior groups tend to favor it in many cases. But this one would be one where the government would replace health plans. Instead of employer-based system, which we have now, we would have government providing the insurance. They wouldn't be providing the care. It's private doctors providing the care. And you go to the doctor, you either have or don't have a copayment, depending on how you design the system, and the bills get paid by the government. It's obviously politically difficult because the easy thing to say is, look, that's going to mean more taxes. Whether you call them premiums or taxes, you are paying more money to the government for it. Less money, your boss is paying less money, you're paying less money in premiums and so on, but the government's paying it instead. And then the benefits of it include that the government can negotiate prices with providers, say, look, you can't just bill whatever you want for that, like the drug industry right now. We're going to say we're only going to provide this much. Canada and the rest of the world with prescription drugs, they don't subsidize drugs when people in Minnesota and most states now go to Canada or Mexico to get drugs. They're not because they're subsidized in those countries. And the drug industry isn't selling them at a loss in those countries. The government says, here's the cap on what we're going to pay for this. And of course, they do charge the cap. But Minnesota, it tends to be about 40% cheaper for drugs in Canada. I remember visiting about 10 years ago a doctor friend in Tucson. They were having trouble with pregnancy, so they wanted fertility medication. They're both doctors, MDs, and they go to Mexico across the border a few miles away because they could get the drugs for about 5% as much. The same drug, same manufacturer, same everything else. But so if government has the chance to set maximum prices on things, you don't have a drug company just charging whatever they want. But under the Medicare for All model, it's basically what Medicare is, only Medicare has in recent years been, most seniors get Medicare coverage, supplemental coverage, because Medicare doesn't cover enough. But it's the Medicare model where you're paying it in taxes. It's not free. And then government is making the payments. The third option, which is sort of a hybrid between the existing model, the cost containment one, and the Medicare for All, I would call the efficiency and best practices model. And it's very similar to the first one, but it has some additions to it that the proponents say would reduce healthcare costs. One of which is you develop best practice models for medical treatment. Some, if you look at childbirth, how many C-sections are provided per 100 births. Some doctors provide a lot more C-sections, or some hospitals, some clinics recommend a lot more C-sections than others do. That's very expensive. If there's a model to determine when it should be done, maybe government should step in and say, we're gonna regulate that, and then the insurers may step in and say, look, this clinic's providing more than that, we're not going to pay for it. Obvious, fraught with danger, and the idea that, well, what if there's a reason these patients of this doctor are more likely to need it? Doctors often very heavily rebel against that because they say, who's making the medical decisions? But that's the idea, that it would have best practices. And doctors do learn from each other. This would be sort of an enforced doctors learning from each other, and the hope would be they learn quicker. But the next thing is creating big purchasing alliances. That's happening some now, but their goal would be to, we get more small businesses together and large businesses together, and by creating a bigger pool, they can negotiate better prices. Again, the downside of that is somebody who's not in the pool ends up paying more. And healthcare providers do charge more to individuals than insured groups. Finally, under this kind of model, the difference between the current one, the biggest difference would be they often would require larger employers to provide benefits, or at least offer incentives. They would try and expand the number of people covered under government programs. So we would get to some more efficiency in terms of preventive care by covering more people. That's the direction it goes in. This is probably the most provide coverage for all children. It's a sort of incremental means of getting more people covered, and it does. That's sort of the two main ones being considered are the current system and this one, where you add on a few things to it. But bottom line is, I think the statistics I said at the beginning about the cost, how we pay 60% more than the next highest country. And it's growing in every country, partly because of new technologies, new other things, but new treatments that prolong life and make life better. But it is getting to the point that our country, because we're so much higher in medical costs, it's causing great problems here. And I think at some point, I don't know when or how, but I think there's going to be a break, and people are going to be demanding significant reform. But presidential candidates on down, nobody's been putting together a big package. The last one I recall was the Clinton one in 92, 93, and it was designed in such a way that the book that contained the legislation was that thick. And if the people presenting it can't explain it, I don't think the public at large can understand it, and it looks like more red tape. So anyway, those are the directions we're heading. I tend to believe that the Medicare for All approach is smartest. I think it's going to, again, most other countries in the world do it that way. That's not saying we have to copy everybody else, and I frankly wouldn't do it the same as every other country. But and I think Americans would, Canada and I think Great Britain, a couple of those countries, there are waiting lists for some routine surgeries, even some where you should be getting them right away. I don't think Americans would stand for that. I happen to think for the $2,000 a person we're spending more than those other countries, we could provide universal care and And you have to fund it enough that you don't have the waiting lines. But anyway, I hope that's a good kickoff for some discussion of this. And you can either argue for a plan, against a plan, or just ask questions or whatever. So
I'm kind of interested in whether there's a happy medium here. You know, on the one hand, clearly we've got a healthcare crisis, and we have the working poor, as we discussed yesterday, and too many people are without healthcare. On the other hand, we know from Canada, and I don't know about all the countries, I do know about Denmark, that if you want something specific and you need it in a hurry, you got a problem. And it's not going to be there. So there would seem to be the philosophical question, and I'm generalizing, of everybody having health care, but at a lower level quality versus a certain group of people having fairly high level health care. And I don't think that's right. But I also don't think it's right that we should sacrifice quality as well. Mm-hmm. And in a discussion you and I had about an hour ago, we talked about how much expense and overhead goes into all of these healthcare companies, many of whom are competing with one another, obviously in a free enterprise system. Now, universal healthcare or single payer is, of course, the antithesis of free enterprise, one could argue. On the other hand, what we've got now is such competition that we are really being abused as patients. And I find myself wondering, putting aside antitrust for just a minute, is there some, you know, is there some middle ground in there?
What I see happening in Minnesota is at least we get fewer and fewer insurers. I mean, we're down to three big ones that cover almost everybody who has insurance covered by them. And they spend a fortune, as you said, the competition between them. The competition isn't, oh, we're going to provide better services, because frankly, they're not providing, in many cases, the services. They're just paying the bills. And even if they are the ones that the HMOs that provide the services as well as the as paying for it, you know, I always wonder how in the world competitive purchasing always requires some knowledge of the consumer. And if you ask me, I had back surgery 12 years ago. Okay, if you ask me to pick between three health plans and I asked every doctor I could think of which one's going to be the best way to cover this, you'd get a whole range of opinions. And when you try and say, take the uninformed consumer like myself, I'm not a, I don't know what they do. I'm learning as I go when you get the problem. And trying to decide between them which is cheaper, realistically, it's more marketing and who can say, and in this case, who can say, we're going to charge you a little bit less here. But all the marketing staff they have, I mean, that's all redundant. I think the one concern that you raise about if you move to some sort of universal system that some people can't get the coverage, I think one of the reasons that it's so important that you, if you're going to move that direction, you have to cover everyone with the same plan. You've got to have the elected officials have the same coverage that everybody else has. I mean, Minnesota, technically, I have the same, we've got the state employee plan. When I have surgery or medical needs somehow or another, we seem to get care right away. And I don't think that's what everybody else is getting from the same plan. I think they're a little more careful with elected officials on it. And you got to have everybody getting the same care so that the people making the decisions of what services are covered. And I would argue that they have to be a comprehensive range of services. If the people making those decisions are in a different plan, if they're somehow out of it, well, the way to do it is cover less. And I think I don't want lower quality health care. I don't think we need that. Countries, I mean, Japan and a lot of countries are doing pretty good quality health care. And I think Canada is really slipping, and I would argue that they're kind of halfway committed to what they have and halfway not sure of it. And so they're cutting corners, and when you do that, you cause the waits, you cause the poor quality of care. But I'm not sure. Maybe others have suggestions or comments on that.
Yeah, I think the trade-off that you're posing is actually, that's why this is such a difficult issue. The actual reality is that more money in healthcare does not necessarily mean better healthcare. And the example that all you have to look at is the largest provider of healthcare in this country after the veteran system is also the best quality and the cheapest provider of health care, and that's Kaiser Permanente. Okay? They provide health care at an average of about $2,500 a year per person. Okay? Consumer Reports in every single geography that Kaiser is operating in has the highest rating of health care from both a business and cost standpoint, efficiency standpoint, and from a medical outcome standpoint. When Kaiser hires doctors, they hire from the absolute best. They get the Stanford, they get the Harvard, they get the best doctors, because doctors have come to know that the best doctors have come to know that if they want to practice the best medicine, Kaiser is the place where they can provide, because it is not the insurance company that makes decisions about care delivery. It's the physicians themselves who make the decisions about where care goes. We have a model in this country where it works. The problem is there is not, you talk about overutilization and underutilization as being separate problems. They're part of the same problem, which is the lack of a systematic approach to performance accountability around healthcare. You talk about not being able to figure out who's your best doctor. But there are systems that do, in fact, measure health outcomes, evidence-based systems, scientific-based systems that measure health outcomes. They just haven't been applied universally in this country because there are political forces that have pushed against those being used in that kind of a way. So it's not a trade-off. If you had single payer and you had a system of performance accountability, forget Kaiser for a second. If you had both of those things in place, where in fact the government required that every healthcare provider put data in, be part of a data system that allowed us to make those assessments, you'd have quality and you'd have universal coverage. But there have been, it is a confusing issue, and there are very strong political forces, in particular the insurance companies, as John's talking about, but also, unfortunately, within the medical practice area. There are a lot of physician organizations that have actively resisted movements towards that kind of accountability. And until we have that accountability, we can actually discuss not, my doctor did this, your doctor did that, but we can actually look at the actual evidence-based health outcomes. We're not going to be able to force those issues around how money is either being wasted because it's being spent on unnecessary procedures, or the wrong procedures, or the wrong medication, or the opposite. We can't have that discussion until we have those systems in place.
On that point, I wonder, how are there a number of doctors in the room, medical providers of other kinds? One doctor, other people provide medical care of various kinds.
Nurse.
Number of you, yeah. I hear from more and more, in every kind of medical profession, people who are complaining. I had one doctor friend who once was trying to give a woman some procedure, and because it wasn't on the insurance plan's coverage, he had to call in to get permission to do it. And the guy was sort of discussing with him, well, why not this procedure? Well, we've done that one, it didn't work. And well, how about this? And so the guy's arguing back and forth about what to do. And all of a sudden the doctor realized, wait a minute, where's your medical degree? And the guy who was a young college graduate who's there as an insurance company worker and has no clue, but telling the doctor this, and the doctor is saying, that's where you just kind of hit it. And every kind of medical profession, you have that kind of thing where you're being told, do your practice this way. That's where you get the concern from the doctors. I think the doctors, most of them that I know, are happy to provide work on what's the best way to do it. That's what they're trying to do, whether it's forced or not. But the current system is such, as you said, that it's opposite of what we want in that way. But, yes. Go ahead.
Another difficulty is the cost of medical education. My son graduated from medical school and residency with $180,000 in debt. So you're starting out as a young man, 30 years old, and you don't have a house, and you owe $180,000. So doctors having to make a choice, many of them make a choice, to go into private practice and to overcharge people.
In bigger cities, too. They don't. You small communities are struggling to get doctors.
Exactly. The doctors are used to living in big cities, so they don't want to go out where they're needed. On the other hand, maybe they're really interested in continuing research, say at a research institution and be an attending physician at a hospital, but it's mind-boggling to me to be 30 years old and $180,000 in debt and no house. I mean, he doesn't have a house to show for that. There was some talk quite a while ago about giving incentives to doctors to have their medical school debt forgiven for going to an area of
underserved
great need.
A number of states do have small efforts like that. But again, that's part of the way we've decided more and more. Partly is medical education is more complex and the cost isn't going to go away. I'm not sure that that's one where you would find a lot of cost savings. I think the thing you have to do, though, is exactly what you're saying. We have to look at who's paying for it, because you don't give the doctor the choice of providing the medicine in the best way possible. They have to look at the bottom line and how they can pay off incredible debts. I mean, I don't think most of us could conceive of dealing with that, and they have that forced on them now. So. Other comments? It doesn't have to can be on this thread or other things.
I work in a hospital, and one of the things over the last probably 5 years, I've been in healthcare a long time, and there's, if at least in Washington State, at least in Western Washington, you can go to any community, and there's hospitals adding on big wings, expensive, putting a lot of money into capital, and also developing programs around, quote, money makers. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason is to try to offset the cost of the losses that they have. But for me, it's just become much, much more of a business and less of meeting the community need. And, you know, and I think a lot of it does have to do with cost and mm-hmm. cost shifting and you know, where the money goes in a hospital.
Minnesota's actually had for about 10 or 15 years a hospital construction moratorium. You cannot add hospital beds. You cannot build a new hospital. We actually needed new legislation to put in a new hospital in a growing suburban community, and first time that's been done since the moratorium. And big fight over the plans. We're all fighting who gets to build that next hospital. And the goal was a lot of the people who were looking at the big picture trying to say, well, they mental health coverage is hospitalization. Hospital beds for mental health are expensive and not necessarily highly profitable. So one of the attempts that didn't succeed was to say the winner of who gets this has to do that. But in Minnesota, it's not the hospital problem. It's the doctors forming their own clinics and getting their own MRIs and other expensive machinery, and some of which is the more profitable stuff, too, which takes away from the hospitals. But that's part of the problem.
Well, our hospital can't, our state, you can't just build another hospital. They have to go through a
certificate.
But it's the current hospitals that are existing.
That are expensive.
And they're shifting, what kind of treatment you provide in the beds that you do have.
Can you talk a little bit about how you see the balance of who should pay, whether it's the patients or the government or the business in terms of premiums? Because, for example, Massachusetts just came up with this new plan, and as a result of the businesses, a lot of businesses kind of got off the hook as far as paying very much. You know, they have to pay something minimal, like $250 a person a year, and they have to pay that as a minimum if they don't offer any kind of insurance. Well, that's not, that's just a small amount. Can you talk about the balance
sure.
between who should pay?
Sure. Well, I can tell you, I frankly think that what we have in our country where employer-based pay in general is a not very smart way to go, partly because people, I'm going to keep my job. They're taking jobs that they're not their highest skill, they're best equipped for, but they take it because it's got benefits, and you need those benefits. And we make a lot of poor economic choices because of that, and I would also argue in terms of international competition. Again, the auto industry I mentioned earlier, we tack on 15% to the cost of every vehicle we produce because they cover that cost. Who pays doesn't necessarily make it cheaper or more expensive. It does the paperwork, though, of who's paying what and so on can be incredibly expensive. I happen to think the smartest way to do it is through a government, the payor, and patients, I think co-payments, some people, co-payments stop people from going. And you can't have co-payments that are high enough that stop people from getting care they need. And again, if you need the care, the goal is to get people who need care getting the care, not to say, well, we'll try and reduce the care we provide that way, because that pushes things away from preventive. But I happen to think some realistic co-payments, maybe based on income, realistic co-payments and government funding, and instead of straight across-the-board premiums, I would have a progressive system for paying for it myself. But there are lots of people who are, one of our current U.S. senators got elected saying he was going to provide, I think, more of the Massachusetts model, what it's supposed to do, is one, require coverage for everyone, and two, require employers to provide it. I'm not sure that makes the most sense, but a lot of people who are without health insurance, they don't care how they get it, they just want it. I'll get to you again, but there's a couple of...
My husband and I own our own business, and so we provide health insurance we have 18 employees, and we provide the health insurance, and we will cover up to $100 a month per employee. But we still have, out of the 18 employees, I think we have six that, even though we cover $100 of it per month, and then we take it bi-weekly out of their check, that they still are like, you know, it's too much money, we can't afford it, we never go to the doctor, so we're just not going to take it. And it's just, for us as an employer, we want the best from our employees.
Right.
Yeah. So it's really hard for us to be like, you can't just live without health insurance. So you've been healthy for 10 years. You don't know what's going to happen.
You don't know what's
tomorrow.
Happening tomorrow, yeah.
But in the same sense, though, as an employer, we, every year, health insurance rises. Every year, we have to go through the process of to negotiate with another company, and then everything has to change. All of our employees have to fill out that 3 pages of paperwork again every year. It is so frustrating and so time consuming on my time to do this. And I just think this is ridiculous as an employee.
That's again, 30 cents of every dollar we spend is on the paperwork stuff.
Yes.
Your staff time, your time negotiating with the plans, and everybody switching around. Plus, you lose the continuity of care. I mean, that's the other problem with the employer base. I switch jobs. Oops, goodbye, doctor, who's treated me for 20 years. I got somebody new now. And again, your business is succeeding somehow or another in providing it now, but more and more are getting to the point where they can't. And I mean, somebody has to take responsibility for it. And if you look at the administrative costs of a system like Medicare, it's far less administrative costs than when you have all this switching and everything else. But that's one of the arguments why I think the employer base doesn't make a lot of sense.
Is there any indication that the people of Canada are less healthy or have poorer care?
They're actually
because of their system.
They're actually doing a lot better than us in terms of the standard measures of care. And I don't think their care is worse. I think the problem, which was mentioned earlier, is that because there's shortage of some providers and so on, that you have a long waiting list for some things, which can reduce your quality of care. I mean, if you need kidney transplant's not the right example because you're more likely waiting for the organ than for whatever.
You can't get that here either.
Yeah. but the problem becomes with things where you could provide it now, it's just you don't have enough bed spaces or whatever to do it. So that's my point. I wouldn't copy what Canada does. I would copy the overall structure of which a single provider, the Medicare example. But I don't think, I think the biggest failing of their system is the fact that they don't fund it appropriately. And I don't think they have to pay as much as we pay for it in order to do that. I think if instead of being 60, 70% less than us, if they were only 30% less than us and they provided high quality care, it helps in so many ways. Who haven't I got over here? I'll get back to some of you too.
Just speaking from a Canadian's perspective, the health care that we have in Canada, it is a universal health care program. And I think as John Marty's indicated, we do get an excellent level of care. And I think that our cost is substantially lower than it is in the U.S. I believe that 9% of our GDP is spent on health care in Canada, and I believe that the number in the U.S. is somewhere around
15
14 or 15
now.
15%. So the cost, overall cost, is lower, and there is funding considerations which certainly need to be fixed. When they talk about the waiting list, which is really our biggest problem, if you're in a situation needing critical care or it's an emergency, you get health care and the best health care at that time. If you need a knee replacement or a hip replacement, you would go on in the queue, and you might be waiting 3 months, you might wait 6 months to have that. Now, when you need your knee replaced, that's not a very nice project, but a prospect. But, you know, I guess if you're going to have a system, I think, that's universal, you've got to take a look. If you've got a system which has capacity to provide every service on demand, you're going to have excess capacity, which means higher cost. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of where we're at. Certainly, when our waiting lists have gotten long, we've sent people from Vancouver to Bellingham or Seattle to shorten the waiting list, because it's cheaper for us to send people down where they've got excess capacity and pay the higher cost than it is to build all the facilities that you want.
So in your case, the province actually pays to send people here?
Yeah, they would, yeah.
Rather than put in more spots for certain types of procedures?
That's right.
They do in Minnesota too, actually, John.
Oh, we...
Yeah,
you get some patients from there,
right? Yeah.
That are, yeah, because it's government funded. Right?
That's
interesting. But I was going to say, where you draw the line? You're saying it's 9% of GDP there. You know, if you upped it 10% to 10%,
and I think, I mean, that's certainly in the last while, when we had budget cuts, that was one of the areas when you're spending a good portion of your government funds.
Right.
Meanwhile, everything gets cut. Now that we're certainly in a better financial position in Canada, the healthcare funding has increased, and there's, you know, restrictions on waiting lists and all this other kind of stuff. But you know, as far as quality of care, I think we have some of the best physicians that there are in Canada. Mm-hmm. We've got certainly, you know, expertise that I think we're well to be proud of. One of the things that I haven't heard anybody talk about down here that I think in the U.S. that really needs to be part of the discussion is how about your tort reform, so that maybe the physicians that are not going to have to pay these horrendous insurance premiums that you do have down here. I don't know what yours would be, but the over in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Especially in certain professions, certain medical professions, is very high. OBGYNs in a couple of places, there are real shortage of doctors willing to practice that because of cost.
I don't think politicians really understand that, John. They think it's OBGYN and they think it's a real surgery.
Oh, I know. It's across the board.
What it is, every single patient you see in the office, if they don't feel good, you've got to cover your bases.
Right.
And that means ordering tests. If you come in the emergency room with a headache, it's clearly a migraine, and that's a clinical diagnosis. There's certain characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get out of there without a CAT scan. That's $1,000.
Yeah.
But that's not in every practice environment.
And the only reason you don't is you can't take the chance on the 0.1% of people who may have a certain...
And part of it would be, part of that, I would argue, would be who's providing the insurance. Because in states, I mean, I know in many cases, in workers' compensation insurance and so on, the state has cut way back on limits of responsibility and so on. Premiums don't go down, and which is a real problem with our system, because again, our liability insurance system isn't regulated in that way. So, if we provided something that was going to provide a 20% cut in cost, in risk outlay to the insurance company, they're still going to, they might cut their cost by 2% and say, look, we cut it because of this. I would argue it is a big portion, and it's not just the premiums, because the all the payouts from settlements and so on in Minnesota in a year are a lot less than Bill McGuire makes from as the CEO. But it is a real significant portion. And I mentioned that earlier as one of the issues where there are two reasons doctors might perform more tests, one of which is if they have a financial interest in, we 10 of us doctors got together, we got an MRI clinic. You're going to tend to push people that way more. And the other one is the liability issue, because you don't want to take the chance.
I can say a couple of things as an insider. I'm an oncologist, and I see a skewed population. I see people that are diagnosed with cancer, and I we can really deliver a lot to the individual patient right now, but it's very expensive. But I just see a couple of things. One is the improvement that we've had in longevity in our country has mainly come from clean water, clean air, immunizations, and antibiotics. And most of that happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and to some extent the 70s. But the life expectancy is plateauing, actually, and most of the boom in our life expectancy happened during those years, and it was due to those factors, not due to cardiac stents and bypass surgery and even cancer care. And that's one thing that I don't think our public understands. And that's the reason why our mortality isn't as good as it is in Europe and Canada.
Mm-hmm. And again, when you're dealing with environmental issues, what's the cheapest way to deal with cancer? It may be to prevent certain things from happening.
That's right. But the other thing I just wanted to say is that the one area I disagree with you at is people really don't mind going to the doctor. You might not like to, but utilization is high. I work for a nonprofit, large clinic of 400 physicians on salary. We have a city of 100,000 people and a drawing area of maybe 600,000 for healthcare. When I went there 30 years ago, we've got three times as many physicians right now as we did when I moved there, and our population base is about the same. And when I was a kid in the 1950s, I think I went to the doctor twice, once with a broken arm and once for a Boy Scout physical. And we didn't utilize healthcare. We didn't have emergency rooms that took care of primary care. That happened in the 1960s and 70s.
But see, part of that is just because the emergency room for primary care is one of the big problems.
Yeah. But the other thing I think that's got to be part of our discussion is that the law of supply and demand doesn't work in our country in healthcare. People's healthcare needs are a bottomless pit. And healthcare competition, if you've got two healthcare systems in the same city, they're both going to charge the same amount of money. For an MRI or whatever it is, they have no incentive to cut their costs, and you have to do it because the guy down the street is doing it, and you've got to provide that care if you want to keep your patient population base. And so competition, capitalism in healthcare actually just isn't working, and the only people making any money right now are the pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies.
Yeah. You've got to talk about those when you talk
about
them. And people may see practices building big hospitals and stuff, but when you look at the bottom line in Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic right now has I think their annual revenues are $6 billion. They have a profit margin of 3%. Mm-hmm. I work for a healthcare system that has annual revenues of $600 million. And we have a profit margin of less than 1%. We're on the edge.
It's the United Healthcare, is it?
Right. We're providing, if you come to our emergency room and you got a bad problem, we take care of it. But there's case mixing that goes on, so the people with insurance, and if the people with insurance can't cover it, the provider covers it. We pay for it.
And you shift it to others.
Right. But don't we need a new vision? I mean, isn't there something that politicians and the church could do? The country was dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If they wrote it now, they'd say health, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the greatest concept of making all this affordable is insurance. Insurance works because everybody's in the pool, so you've got everybody putting in. And the moral thing is very simple. When you're born, you don't know who you're going to be. Are you going to be the guy who gets cancer, the one who has a car accident, one lives forever. That's a claim that both politicians and the church, if you rethought all of our being in the same boat, it would be a lot easier to make the kinds of choices, instead of competing with each other and gaming the system and all the things that we're doing, you'd have a different foundation for making the choices, and I think it would be a lot easier, because then when you say, well, the politicians shouldn't get any better health care than anybody else. If they don't like it, we don't like it.
Right.
And once we're all in the same boat, this is not that big a problem, because group health, like Kaiser Permanente, has shown that you can do it.
I'm not quite sure why that model doesn't work elsewhere. I mean, there was no place in our country, there's no place in our country that knows HMOs better than Minnesota did. We were ahead of Kaiser Permanente in HMOs. And it was, Kaiser Permanente works because they got big and because they have their, they serve population areas with a lot of young people.
That's not true.
And a lot of people with good jobs.
Yeah. Kaiser Permanente's population is older than the rest of the population that they serve.
Yeah. No, I got nothing against Kaiser Permanente.
I'm saying you're wrong about
Kaiser
the demographics.
Doing a great job. I'm just not sure why that doesn't work in other places. Because they got a good thing going.
I was going to say, I mean, in terms of the vision thing, I happen to think that we're going to be, that's why I favor the Medicare for All model, because I think you've got to start with a place where we're going to provide coverage. I mean, the one thing Clinton's big, fat health care plan had that was understandable was when he pulled out his health, he says, you have a Social Security card, we're going to give you a health security card, you go to the doctor when you need to go to the doctor. And yes, how you deal with issues, I listed overutilization as a problem. I listed it as a problem that is less big than the underutilization issue, because I think it is far less, and it's where we spend all our efforts. But I think you do start with that vision of it and move there, because, again, other countries, it's not rocket science. Other countries have provided universal health care and fairly well, and at a much cheaper rate than ours. But I think that's the direction we have to go. We have time for one more. Ingrid, you had your hand up for quite a while, I know.
Oh,
I think it was you.
Oh, it's a huge thing, but there's a lot of research, very good research, that shows that one of the biggest predictors of a healthy country or healthy population is a small disparity between the rich and the poor. And it doesn't mean you have to be rich. It means that there's really dramatic correlation between not a lot of variation between the in the demographics between the rich and the poor in a community produces a healthy community, even if most people are on the poor end. But as long as there's no rich people there, then. I mean, it's really true that economics determine a lot about health care and the economic health of the community. And then, of course, there are all these other things, like if your community is got a lot of wild dogs, you should get rid of the wild dogs. I mean, there are a lot of ways to reduce the health care costs of a community besides clinics and hospitals. I mean, providing health care turns out to be way down the list when you look at the research. There are lots of other kinds of ways to produce a healthy community before hospitals.
The two areas where I'd say the biggest savings potential are, one is the administrative cost, which is just killing us, and number two, I would say the prevention, which may be sort of what you were getting at there, but the whole idea, you're not going to save that much money. I mean, technology is going to move its own direction, and there may be some big savings, there may be a lot more expenses with it. But it seems to me that the one area where you have great potential is taking away the person who goes to the emergency room in order to get a prescription filled because they don't have the $5 that they needed or $20 they needed for the copayment.
You see, that over then spawns another thing. We have now in Phoenix, Arizona, because everybody who didn't have insurance and overflooding, 10-hour waits in emergency rooms, now urgent cares are popping up all over the place. So right away, the ambulance, the person that goes into the emergency room goes to the attached urgent care, doesn't use the facilities of the emergency room in the hospital, and speeds things up. And that was sort of came as an invention out of the crisis, which I think we're good at. Now we're getting so many numbers of uninsured that we have to really concentrate on how to deliver to that. And I worked for Carondelet, and I volunteer at Mayo, and so I know in Arizona what they're trying to do with greater access. And it's a tremendous cost finding. And Medicare fraud is a tremendous problem. And the administrative costs of Medicare, just Medicare, and getting those payments to the doctors and the other health care providers. Before you go Medicare for all, that has to be really cleaned out as a model. And nobody's really talking about that. In fact, they're adding to the problem with this restriction.
I'd be happy to talk more. I think this is a topic we could talk for two more hours on. I'm going to call it official halt now because it's 5 to 12 already. And I'm happy to stay around more and talk some more if people want. And I'd love to talk with you about the Medicare fraud issue because I have some comments on that. But thank you very much.